Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Strasinski with Libby Law Firm, and I represent the Friends of Minnesota Public Television and serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Television Association. With me today is Dean Orton, who's Executive Vice President of Twin Cities Public Television, who'll be speaking on behalf of the association at large. Just a couple of introductory comments, Mr. Chairman. We're pleased, as always, to be here today before you. And just like Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, although it's a little frozen this morning, and we like each and every one of you just the way you are, you know, so that's really good. And thank you for coming to listen to our stellar presentation. Public television has been around for a lot of years. Your division has funded public television grants going back into the 70s that I'm familiar with, because that's how far back I go, into the 1970s, into the Department of Administration. It's a really important. We're community-based, and the money you provide for our operating and equipment grants through your division are extremely important, because they're kind of the fundamental grant that helps enable leverage from other places, other foundations and philanthropic support that we secure. Bottom line is, public television, although it's not a school, we're all about education. Public television is not a social service agency, and yet we think we can improve people's lives throughout the state. We're not a symphony, we're not a theater, we're not a museum, and yet we chronicle important parts of history throughout those regions, and we bring arts and culture into every home in Minnesota. We're pleased with our reach. At this point, I'll turn it over to Mr. Orton to make a little presentation.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Yes. Good morning. I am Dean Orton, the Chief Operating Officer for Twin Cities PBS, but also today I have the privilege of representing the five other public television stations in Minnesota and helping represent MPTA. So I'm pleased to be here this morning. I prepared just some remarks and just take a few minutes and also leave time, hopefully, for some questions. I'm here to provide a general overview of public television in Minnesota. My guess is that PBS has touched each of your lives in some way over the years. Your children, your grandchildren, many have turned to us for the best educational programming for kids anywhere. Many of you have been on Almanac, and others have certainly through your local public television stations through debates. My guess is it's a number of you just in the last few weeks, maybe you've tuned in for Masterpiece Theater, Antiques Roadshow, NOVA, award-winning science program. So you're familiar for some of what we do and how we serve Minnesota. But what we all need a little reminding briefly from time to time is why public television came to be and why we seek public support for what we do. More than ever, there is a need for public media. He uses the power of television in a rapidly growing list of other digital platforms, first and foremost for public service with a mission in a not-for-profit way. In a famous speech the FCC Commissioner Newton Minow made in the 60s, where he coined the phrase, television was a vast wasteland, he also said about television, when you aim everything at a bottom line, you aim too low. And so in the 50s, Congress recognized that as well and created non-commercial television. Congress specifically charged public television stations with the responsibility to forever preserve an opportunity for all citizens to have access to non-commercial media in order to provide for a free exchange of information and ideas essential to our democracy. While in other industrialized and civilized countries, non-commercial television is fully funded by tax dollars or licensing fees, in our country, we are funded through a public-private partnership, and that's why we're here today. A little more specifically about public television in Minnesota. It is unique in that it is made up of six separate organizations. Each has its own local board. It's independent control, serving unique needs different to the regions of our state. They are all separate by geography, but we all are interconnected via state's fiber backbone system. And this technology allows us then to collaborate and broadcast and serve statewide. Again, although we are independent, we work closely and we share a shared purpose, using television and other media for public good. Some examples of these activities for providing lifelong educational opportunities are partnering with the government and nonprofit organizations to help them achieve their mission and purpose. We provide news and public affairs programming with civil discussion can take place about the pressing issues of the time. We provide a safe educational learning environment and prepare our kids for school. We now have dedicated 24/7 channels. We have even a richer online experience than ever before for not only teachers, but parents and caregivers, all to help our Minnesota children be ready to learn, go to school. Public television in Minnesota strives to be a local voice for communities through the state, not just in the metro area. Again, this is facilitated by the fact that each regional public television station is independent and provides its own unique local programming and meet the needs specific to their region. For example, Lakeland Public Television, which operates a transmitter in Brainerd and Bemidji, serves a vast geography region from north central Minnesota, from Little Falls all the way up to the Canadian border. They're the only television station doing news in that region and paying attention to that area and serving them with local programming and content. So I'd like to recap a little bit about a few facts more about MPTA and then some closing comments and questions. Again, our mission is to enrich lives and strengthen our communities through the power of media. We focus on programming on advancing education, our culture, history, heritage, and civic engagement. We reach over 5 million residents, the entire state, over the air, free and available, as well as on cable, satellite, and really what is a rapidly growing number of online streaming and just other distribution platforms continuing to evolve and grow. Each station develops its own local programming, important to its own viewers. Public television provides educational services to over 275 school districts, over 192,000 students. Finally, there's perhaps no investment in state funds that benefit as many people as does the investment in Minnesota PBS stations. We serve more people more often than any other cultural or educational organization in Minnesota. More than the public schools, universities, more than the museums or parks. In just a matter of a couple of weeks, 2 million people turn to their local public PBS stations here in Minnesota to be educated, entertained, and informed. Just in closing, our mission really is basically the same as yours. We want an educated and informed public and develop good citizens. We always have and will continue to use state dollars wisely, and with this investment we'll continue to bring programs for Minnesota and about Minnesota to a statewide audience. Thank you for your time. I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and testifiers. Thank you for being here today. Just to clarify, I know we have some new people here, and maybe they know, maybe they don't. But you know, the public television, the name itself suggests that it's owned and operated by the state. But just for clarification to them, can you tell us, you know, who actually owns it, what kind of entity it is, where your money is dispersed out, you know, as far as wages, what do your CEOs make and then also wages as opposed to what goes into programming?
Mr. Chairman, there's a lot to Representative Green. Thank you for the question. Compare it to a lot of states in Minnesota, in the United States, including states surrounding Minnesota, public television is owned by the government. So it might be part of an academic institution or universities, but the taxpayers shoulder the total cost of those facilities in their respective states. In Minnesota, public television emerged in the 60s and early 70s as nonprofits for the communities they serve. So the state taxpayers of Minnesota are partners with us. They don't shoulder all of the costs. They shoulder some of the costs. So that's really an important distinction, I think, and why this program was created in the first place. As for salaries, I think our salaries are competitive in the public television world, certainly not competitive with commercial broadcasters. I'm not sure what all the salaries are. We can provide you with that kind of information if it's of interest to the committee. what CEOs make, and in fact, it is disclosed in all of our reports because we file reports with the Attorney General's office as nonprofits. But certainly, a lot more money goes into our programming, as you know. In fact, in legacy programs alone, which you're familiar with that program, Representative Green, we don't use indirect costs or whatever. All the money we get from the state of Minnesota is put specifically into programming and provides those kinds of services. So it's really important. And I can share with you one other observation about this, and I was going to conclude my comments with how the statute works. We are funded through your division under Chapter 129D. There's a specific matching grants and equipment grants program in statute. So when you provide us money in the operating grant side of it, and money does get used to pay for operational costs of the station, and we report this to the Department of Administration every year. Those reports are certainly available now, and specifically how we spent that money. We have to raise money locally, philanthropically, and in order to match the state dollars that are available in the formula. We can't use federal dollars. We can't use other state dollars to match those local. It has to be money from the local community or corporations. We can do that, but they have to also be based in Minnesota. So that's how that statute operates. The statute, unfortunately, or this division never fully funded that formula, so we always raise more money locally than we can get from the state of Minnesota. And the other grants program is equipment grants. So we take money from the equipment grant side that you provide and use that for smaller equipment items, usually, whether it's computers or encoders or whatever, within the station operations. We do have a much larger equipment grant program we'll be talking about later on this session, I think, with you, our request. But that's how we use our money. It's really important to serve the communities in Minnesota. And so, you know, we're very pleased with all of that. And so, you got any details?
No, there are in public media different license types, and you can, in terms of who holds the license for what we do. In our situation in Minnesota, we have community licenses, and that means there's a volunteer board. All of our respective MPTA stations have an amazing group of community leaders across the state, a diverse group helping lead and supervise all the activities of each of the independent stations. So we are licensed to the community that is then governed by a board of directors who are volunteers representing that community. And then so they provide oversight and make sure best practices and truly the mission is upheld. And there is other licenses types. Some can be owned by school districts. Some can be owned by the state. But in our case, they're community licensed and a volunteer board of directors seeing oversight. We certainly, again, have full public files and continue to make sure that all information is available. We just released, again, our 990, so all of that is public. We survive off our relationship with our audiences. We have over roughly 200,000 individual homes across Minnesota that are contributors. And so we survive off of our relationships and the goodwill that we are using our money wisely and providing service. And if we don't do that, our core funding, which is our members, will go away. And so we're really beholden to our audience and making sure that we are really meeting our mission.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification. I think it's important for people to know, you know, where that comes from. The other question I have is when we had public radio in, they talked about their listeners, and I see you say that you have 900,000 listeners a week, and they estimate theirs by how much how many people contribute, and then they times that by a certain amount and estimate their listeners. How do you do you have an outside company come in and do some kind of testing to see how many people actually listen and how many are repeat listeners?
Yeah.
So that the 900,000 is an actual number and not someone that views in once every day per week.
Yeah, no, thank you for asking. This is an area we spend quite a bit of time thinking about. And the main service we use is Nielsen, which has been around forever in the broadcast world, and they've got a methodology that is pretty much the industry standard of how they come and give us numbers. So it is third-party arm's length, and we get information from them daily, and then quarterly, and then over the year we get deeper information. But to the extent that, yes, so there's a third-party service. They provide the data. We look at it in terms of non-duplicated reach, so how many people do you reach without counting them twice? And then we also look at how many times people will come back. We have people that will spend, 20, 30 hours a week with us. So there's ways we look at it both in how many we reach and then how frequent or how loyal, how much time they do spend and come back how many times. So we do look at both, and both are important for us to understand. That helps.
Senator Green?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My question has to do with our aging population. Mm-hmm. You stated in your testimony that you serve regions where there is no cable service, so public television is over the air and people receive their news that way. I'm also concerned about, have you done any studies about our aging population and how your service will be important to them as mm-hmm. they cut back their budgets and they're on fixed incomes, and what reach even in cable communities? But also, there's so much talk about greater Minnesota with the lack of broadband and the lack of cable mm-hmm. services. Do you have any idea of how many members that you serve, or not members, but how many people you serve in our communities and that aging population going forward?
Mr. Ward.
Certainly, I'll share a few thoughts and then certainly could do further follow-up. This area, obviously, we spend a lot of time we serve age ranges from 2 to 102 in our service, but in particular, especially in public media, a 60-plus audience spends a lot of time with us. And so we have a lot of ideas of and design our service knowing about their interests. So we certainly spend a lot of time thinking about and programming so that there's something in that age grade that really are paying attention. We most recently launched an entire service dedicated to that age group mm-hmm. called Next Avenue, where we really think about all the issues of that stage of life yeah. and what are the particular issues relevant to them, what do they need to know, what services and information can we provide them to help them live a richer life within that stage of life. So from dedicated entire services that publish and create content for them each and every day now, to our programming that you experience 24/7 programming-wise, we think about that. And yes, we really do value that without the cost of a cable bill or anything, that you can get our service free. And more we're seeing statistics about cable cutting and information that even makes the broadcast becoming even more important again as it kind of cycles back. So we do spend a lot there. I hope that answers, but we are thinking about services, programming, local content created. We have folks that produce and think about that audience on an ongoing daily basis.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's really important. The Dean's shy about that, or didn't say, but that program, Next Avenue, gets over 3 million web views a month.
Mm-hmm. It goes national, and that's national. It's Minnesota-based, but national in scope, so that's
all kinds of significant program. And our regular web views for like our legacy programs and stuff, we developed 990 teacher guides last year. We're used by 20% of the teachers in Minnesota download legacy programs off our websites for free and use them in the classrooms. We've broadcast thousands of hours, and we've had 2.6 million web views on our legacy program alone, because we can track that with public television. We're pretty good at tracking statistics. So we've got a lot of good information, and thank you. That was a wonderful question. So.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Orton, just curious, as Minnesota grows, our population is getting more diverse. What has public television do to match that and to reach out to those diverse communities, and are we do you have a group that looks at this to make sure we're touching all those communities, or what exactly are you doing? Thank you.
Yeah, I know. I think this is a particular area, just as we think about the aging demographic and how we continue to serve them with programs and services. This is an area where, in Minnesota, we've blazed kind of even new trails for public media on a national scale, where we've looked at what we've called partnership work. And for the last 15 years, and now we have just relaunched what we're calling Partnerships 2.0, service with nonprofits. And really what that allows us to do, we partnered with over 60 nonprofit organizations just last year. And what it really allows us to do is to work with those organizations that are really looking at the issues of what's changing within our community and collaborate with them and help figure out what their voice, what their mission, how do we help better engage people around the issues that they're facing or working to solve with their mission. And so we have huge collaboration each year, year in, year out, with a group of a division within our public media organization that thinks and reaches out and works with the community, and through that, most through those nonprofits, really get at a lot of the change in what's going on, and not only in the area of diversity, but it also can be in any range of kind of social services and any other nonprofit area. But it is an area we all the stations across the country are in particular are paying attention to, and we're thinking even more about new initiatives that we will launch. There's an interesting statistic that about 100 years ago, 70% of all Minnesotans either had parents or were foreign-born. Okay, in less than 100 years now, 10% of our Minnesota base is either parents have foreign-born or foreign-born themselves. But there's a change in the demographic going back again the other way. And so we are spending a lot of time thinking about the shifts in our audience, and that's what we do in public media, putting our audience first. But I'm glad you're interested in that space, and we're thinking a lot more about what the program and services are and how do we capture the stories that help us all understand who we are as Minnesotans.
And members, we've got a couple other things going on here. We got a bill coming up. We need to move this along, and if we can make the answers a little shorter, I think we can get through this.
Sure.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, you mentioned cutting the cable. I grew up where, you know, we did over the air, and I know a lot of people were pleased when HD came out in the sidebands and the multi, you know, you've got four or five channels for each of your public ones and their reach. What proportionality of the local programming is available over the, you know, internet? Because a lot of millennials, they have the internet and they don't have anything else that they use. Sure. So maybe the local programming, and you mentioned you had recorded, but also, you know, what percentage is covered live?
Just briefly, we continue now more and more. We've launched new services called Passport, so we've created so that it's all available online. We're being added as streaming live, so basically you can get it through your broadband live broadcast streaming that way, so basically the new way if you look at over-the-air equivalent, or if you just want to watch at your time in your place. We're basically kind of anywhere you want to be, whether that's on a mobile device or on the 60-inch big television in your room, but we're figuring out how to have those access to our programming. So it continues to be linear, but it also convenes on-demand and kind of in the different devices as well. So all that continues to advance for us.
Representative Kwan, thank you. Any further questions? Well, thank you. And thank you for the information.
Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you.
And next we have John Kavanaugh from the Minnesota Public Radio. And introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your presentation. And
Chair Nelson and members, I'm John Kavanaugh with Minnesota Public Radio. I first of all want to thank all of you individually. Most of you have met with us or are scheduled to meet with us in the near future to talk about our request from the committee. And I also want to thank you for offering time for us today to talk about the equipment grant that we have received over the past, I believe, about 20 years now. Need to remember to do my presentation at the same time here. Minnesota Public Radio actually provides the backbone of the emergency alert system throughout Minnesota. We actually provide a signal not only to our listeners, but we also provide for all the media outlets outside of the metropolitan area. We actually provide for some in the metropolitan area, but this presentation is for the rural areas of the state. Since the beginning, MPR, since the beginning of the EAS system, MPR has built a statewide system that can serve all of Minnesota. We actually reach about 97% of the state population, and actually it may be bumping up even more than that with our signal. But under our signal, we're only allowed to claim so much of the space. The signal may be received, but it may not be a circumstance that the it falls within the FCC definition of a signal. If you take a look at this map in front of you, that these are actually the stations that we have throughout the state of Minnesota. The second map, which follows, we have actually 80 stations throughout the state that provides the signals that I'm speaking of. We actually reach, as I said earlier, it says 95 on the page here, but it actually is 97%. And this map is actually the signals that we have throughout the state of Minnesota. It may look like there's some areas that are not being served. Most of those areas can receive a signal. It may not be at that level that the FCC defines as a signal. The emergency alert system was developed, I believe, in the mid-90s, and actually it's overseen in part by the MN-IPAS system. There's actually quite a few people that are involved, or quite a few organizations that are involved in that, and this is simply a list of some of those. If you look, WCCO Radio also assists in providing a signal to the emergency alert system throughout the metropolitan area, as does Minnesota Public Radio. Not only do we provide the emergency alert system signal throughout rural Minnesota, we also work with the State Services for the Blind in providing radio talking books to your residents who may be sight impaired. They actually have access to Star Tribune, Pioneer Press, Christian Monitor, among other periodicals and other books that allow them to keep up to date on a daily basis. They actually receive a radio from the department. It's actually under D, but it's under the Minnesota State Services for the Blind. And they receive signals directly from our stations throughout the state as well. We also, Minnesota Public Radio also provides some bandwidth for school districts in the state as well. Those are listed in part on the same slide that I'm on right now. Fergus Falls Public Schools, Go Otters, actually I taught in Fergus Falls for 10 years. They receive a signal, actually they use it for their students so that they have access to the internet if they don't have it at home. So that's great. We also provide some for Duluth Public Schools, FSU Mankato, and also the University of Minnesota Rochester. Two years ago, the legislature provided $1.02 million for the biennium for Minnesota Public Radio to maintain equipment to make sure that the emergency alert system is functioning and actually is working with our partners as well so that Minnesotans are given some safety alerts. We not only provide for like the amber alerts that many of you are familiar with, we also provide weather alerts. There could be chemical spill alerts, and the list goes on and on. But again, the number one thing is we want to make sure that the system is kept up to date and that Minnesotans are given adequate alerts when danger arises. Of the FY18 grant that we received, there was $710,000. $400,000 of that was one-time funding. $310,000 is on the base, and the $310,000 on the base also goes to fiscal year 2019 as well. I think it's fair to ask, how have we spent the money? If you take a look, I believe it's scrambled on the page and on the video screen, but actually on your printout, it should be easier to read. We actually did a complete studio overhaul at Collegeville this year. Not only is the studio new, but actually the equipment that is contained in that was also updated so that it matches up with the EAS system. We also have had equipment updates. And if you take a look, it's a long list of rural communities. That includes outdated exporters, importers, transmitter exciters as well. We also have actually installed remote control capabilities as well, so that we're able to operate the system without having someone on site to deal with issues that arise. The last thing that we focus on is unforeseen equipment failures due to weather, due to climate, due to old aging equipment. I believe our equipment is about between 25 and 30 years old. So we are actually trying to replace that on a continuing basis. In fact, our engineering crew has a plan of 25 years out for replacing equipment so that we keep up to date as with our signal. And that, I believe, also, when we switched over to the HD, I believe that also created some difficulties for us. But, again, the legislature provided for us in that circumstance, and those are all up to date. Again, this slide looks a little bit different on the video screen than actually the one that was provided for you up front. We are currently in fiscal year 2019. We have used, at this point in time, we've had an emergency that we dealt with in La Crescent, Minnesota. But we are also focusing on a number of things, including dealing with some processor installations, and then also rack mounts in several of those communities on that list. I want to focus on one thing, or a few things here. But the equipment grant that you have so kindly provided for us in the past is only for maintaining and replacing equipment for MPR's Greater Minnesota stations. It does not go to the metropolitan area at all. The Greater Minnesota stations are membership-based. Although they're very kind, the reality is that they do not operate, or we don't receive the donations to the degree that we can operate them, if you want to say profitably. But we do actually have the metropolitan members who are very kindly helping us with maintaining those stations and keeping them up and making sure that our system is providing in part for the emergency alerts as well. Things that we do not use this funding for: stations in the Twin Cities, any programming. We do not use it for salaries at all, and we do not use it for travel and food. This is only for equipment. This is only for actually making sure that our system is functioning properly for the emergency alert system. As we look forward to the next biennium for years 2021, we have a list of replacement projects that include the list that's on the screen right now, and then also is on, I think it's slide 13 of the handout. And again, it's quite extensive, but again, when you have 80 stations throughout the state, you're going to have a constant need for equipment replacement. We may be coming back to committee, but we will be proposing that we are funded at the level that we requested the last biennium, which is $1.07 million. One of the things we would love to see that funded up front, but we also recognize that because of budget constraints, things are not as easy for you as a committee to actually fund. We received one-time money of $400,000 in the first year of this biennium. We would love to see actually that money go on the base, but we also recognize that with the constraints that you have as a committee, we would also welcome the one-time funding as well. Try to cut this down as quickly as possible because I know that you have bills, but I will gladly stand for questions.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Now, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I need to apologize because I had said that Minnesota Public Radio used an estimate for their listeners, but that was amperes. Can you tell us how you come to your number of listeners that you figure tune in every week?
I will echo essentially what. Mr. Chair, Representative Green. Sorry. I will echo what Public Television also said. We do have Nielsen. We actually have a rating system that I believe comes out quarterly. I'll gladly provide you with the latest update. We get not only information on our listeners, but we get information on other radio station listeners as well. So at this point in time, I believe the last quarter, we had about 1 million listeners per week.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, then to clarify, you didn't have to answer this, but just to make sure the committee members know that, like public television, you are not owned by the state. You are a private entity that gets money from the state.
Correct. We are a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, and we do not have owners per se.
No, one more question, and then I'll end. You know, I look at your map here, and it does show some areas that are not served. And my area looks like it's not served very much, but I can tell you that if I'm home and I hit seek, I can get no less than 5 and sometimes 8 public radio stations. And so even on your circles here, there's a lot of duplication. Do you need that many stations out there when you're scrambling for money?
Mr. Kavanaugh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, to ensure that we do have that coverage, yes, we do. As a northern Minnesota boy, I love the days that there would be a forest fire up in Canada. That sounds horrible. But actually, we could receive Canadian television at that point. And those are some of the things that affect our signal. Actually, the quality of your radio that you have, the weather, the land formations within your district actually determine how effective that signal is. Again, we can only claim to have a signal if there's 60 dBU or a certain voltage that is received from your radio. And so ultimately, we want to make sure that the entire state is covered. And again, for my presentation purposes, for the emergency alert system.
Representative Green. Any other questions? If not, thank you for your presentation, and thanks for coming to the committee this morning on this nice and warm Minnesota morning.
Indeed, thank you.
And now we've got a couple of bills, and Representative Carlson will be taking those.
Timing is everything.
Great timing. There he is. Wonderful.
Okay. Next we have on the agenda is House File 14 and House File 17. Just real quick, we have about 55 minutes left before the end of the committee. It's my intention to get through these next two bills on time today. So due to the similarities with House File 14 and House File 17, we will have a thank you, Representative Driscoll, for joining Chair Nelson there at the dais so that you can provide your comments as well. With that, let's see. So recognizing Chair Nelson, would you like to move House File 14?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll move House File 14 to be re-referred to Ways and Means with the recommendation that it go to the General Register. I believe that's where it goes. And as you stated, Representative O'Driscoll's here with me, and House File 17, and the intention in the committee is to hold that over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, because there's a funding piece in here that hits our general fund target that we'll be receiving later. But the two bills have the same effect of what they're trying to do, and I was going to make a joke about it being a cold day in Minnesota before Representative O'Driscoll and I and Representative Nash are on the same bill, but, you know, we have that cold day in Minnesota here today. There's an amendment I have on the bill to get the bill in the proper order that we need it, the A3-1 amendment, and I'd like to move that amendment at this time.
Okay. So Representative Nelson moves House File 14 to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation to be placed in the General Register. As the Chair mentioned, there is an A3-1 amendment, which is the author's amendment. Chair Nelson, is it your intent to move that amendment at this time? And if so, please explain it.
I move that amendment. And what this amendment does, if you read down it on point 2 of the amendment, it lowers the amount from the original bill. The original bill included the extra money they needed for the to make get the match from the federal government. They've already been spending some money that's been through their normal course of action in the Secretary of State's office that is making that match, and so we don't need to include it in there. Also, if we included that matching money in there, it would have to be held over for our budget from the committee. So that's, we're going to just authorize them to spend the federal dollars, which has no effect on our state funding because we've already gotten that money sitting in the bank, and we're only state left in the nation that hasn't authorized their Secretary of State to spend that money. The second part of the amendment, starting on line 1.3, is basically combining language from House File 17 and House File 14 and making this thing an all-encompassing bill. Changes the date, and then on the bottom part here of 1.8, it changes. In the original bill, it said $110,000 had already been spent by the that was being counted towards the match. That's now up to $167,000 that has been expended that toward the match. And so moving forward, hopefully we can either have more money come up that they're already spending in their normal course of action in the Secretary of State's office, or we'll include it in our final budget coming out of this bill, out of this committee. So then, members, that's the amendment, and hopefully I can get your support.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. So this amendment puts the bill into the author's preferred format. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Amendment is approved. We're moving on. Chair Nelson, could you please briefly explain your bill?
Well, as we've talked about before, this bill we had last year was in the parts of this bill, what this bill was, more with the language that Representative O'Driscoll had, was in the omnibus bill from last year. And what it does is it authorizes the Secretary of State to spend federal HAVA dollars that came to us last year and to upgrade our systems to provide cybersecurity for our election system that's in the state of Minnesota. Last year, before the session started, or at the beginning of the session, Secretary Simon was talking about having to include money in his budget request to do this work after the 2016 elections and the problems we had with that. Lo and behold, they weren't expecting money from the federal government. In fact, we were being told from the federal government there was going to be no new HAVA money coming. But last year, early in the year, they did pass legislation that put money out to the states, and of that, Minnesota was going to get $6.59 million, almost $6.6 million. And we're one of six states in the country that when we get federal dollars, we have to pass legislation to authorize the departments to spend it. 44 other states do not do that. When they get the money from the federal government, they can automatically spend it without legislative approval. Minnesota's one of six that does not do that we have to provide that authorization. Currently, we are the only state in the nation that has not passed this authorization for the Secretary of State to spend this money and upgrade our system. So we're already behind the eight ball on that. And as the Secretary of State has said in earlier comments to this committee that 2016, we were one of the states that they tried to get into, that a foreign government tried to get in and mess around in our system. Fortunately, that didn't happen, but there's constant probing of our systems, constant probing of all computer systems. This money goes to help them harden those, upgrade our systems to make sure that we have the necessary protections so that people can't come in and mess with our election systems. You ask why this is important. Imagine showing up on election day and your name being off the election. Now, in Minnesota, with same-day registration, that may not be as critical as other states that you have to register ahead of time, but that can really mess up the election process and have angry voters walking out of the voting booth complaining about the way the government runs our system. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions and I'll let Representative O'Driscoll speak on the bill.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative O'Driscoll, any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit more background to kind of supplement the conversation and comments of Representative Nelson to House File 17. Back last year, towards the end of session, we had been working, as Representative Nelson said, with the Secretary of State's office looking for money for cybersecurity to be able to upgrade the system that was created in 2004 to protect voter data information in the state of Minnesota. My voter information is in that system. All right, my voter information is in that system. Your voter information is in that system. Everybody who's eligible and has voted in the state of Minnesota's information is in that system. And as Chair Nelson had indicated, the state of Minnesota had been shopped, that's the word I like to use, by a foreign government to see if they couldn't penetrate our system and get in and collect information on our voters or manipulate that data. The good news is that we do not use electronic tallying of votes. You take a paper ballot, you go in, you vote, so we always have a hard copy record. So there isn't somebody who can go in and roll the dials one way or the other in an electronic system to throw an election. But they could manipulate the data as to who's an eligible voter, what precincts they're in, and raise havoc in that way. In 2004, when Mary Kiffmeyer was the Secretary of State, that system was created, and I will not speak on behalf of the Secretary of State, current Secretary of State, but he has oftentimes been noted in committee to point out that that system withstood the 2016 attempt to be able to be hacked. Things are only as good as you continue to maintain them and improve those systems. The end of last year, in the budget that President Trump signed that Congress passed, there was money available under HAVA, which is an acronym that stands for Help America Vote Act, to be able to allow for the states to have more money to be able to go in and to shore up their election voters, their election systems and their data registration systems. Minnesota, as we found out and as Representative Nelson has indicated, is eligible for about $6.6 million. There's a 5% match that's required by the federal government. The Secretary of State's office has already, from their general fund budget, expended money on that. That qualifies to meet that match, and they continue to find ways that they can do that, thus bringing down additional dollars that the state has to put in for its match. And in the interim, since that bill that we had, Representative Nelson and I had authored back last session, didn't get signed into law by Governor Dayton, during the interim, I put a bill together that did what we were doing last year. Unbeknownst to me, Representative Nelson was doing the same thing. I've co-authored on his bill, and I have put my bill in. So we've been working this idea forward because we do not believe that voter registration information is a Democrat issue, a Republican issue, or any political issue. It's a Minnesota issue, and so we are here to advance that cause this morning and look for your help and support in backing this. My assumption is going to be that at some point, perhaps today, we will lay aside House File 14 and we'll proceed with House File 17, which Representative Nelson probably is. Oh, we're going to do it the other way, so you're going to have me carry the...
No, I'm set. My mind is...
Yes, I was getting mixed up.
I do, too. I do, too.
I've always told myself, I can remember this because I'm Irish, and it's the 17th, so March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, how I remember it. But apparently that's not working on one of the coldest days in the year, where we're still doing business here in the legislature. But nonetheless, we are endeavoring to get this resolved here for the people in the state of Minnesota. And so, again, as Representative Nelson said, I would also stand for questions on the topic before the committee today.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representatives. Secretary Simon, I see, is here. Before we get to questions, why don't we invite him up to the dais to add his testimony.
Morning.
Welcome, Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I don't want to repeat, so all I'll say by way of adding some information is one key difference between where we left off at the last end of last session and now is that in the interim, as both Representative O'Driscoll and Representative Nelson, Chair Nelson, know, our office convened a working group that's not required by state law, it's not required by federal law, but we thought it was a good and best practice. So we convened a working group consisting of representation of all four legislative caucuses, both members and staff, representatives and advocates from the counties, the cities, the townships, the disability community, and the IT community as well, some of whom are in the audience here today. And we met several times between the close of last session and this December. We broke up into five different subcommittees at one point, so we could really take a deep dive and a deep look into how this money ought to be spent. We thought it was a good practice to be able to come back here to you today in this session and have a roadmap or a menu or a game plan or whatever you want to call it for how to spend this money. And we do have that, and evidence of that is in your materials. I should point out as well that there is a lot of federal oversight of this money. So by authorizing this money today, and ultimately the legislature and the governor authorizing this money, it's not just writing us a check and goodbye. A federal agency called the Election Assistance Commission, or EAC, does rigorous oversight, so much so that we're required to keep track of our time in 15-minute increments so that we can demonstrate with evidence and with receipts and with a paper trail that we're spending the money for the purposes that it was intended. So just so you know, there was rigorous federal oversight, and just at the dawn of this legislative session, we had to provide them with a letter, and we're going to have to do that on an ongoing basis. That's the same process that was implemented for the first batch of HAVA money back in 2003, 2004, 2005, so it's no different. So I just want to assure you that there's going to be ongoing federal oversight, and we're happy to share, as we continue to do, that information with this committee and with all legislators.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. I'm going to ask that you stick around just in case there are some member questions.
Sure.
But is there any other members from the audience that were here to testify? Well, maybe I can free up a seat here. Hello, and welcome to the division. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Hilgard. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Association of Minnesota Counties represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I think I'll be pretty quick and just say that we appreciate the bipartisan support of this bill. Counties were members of those work groups, and we felt it was an inclusive and collaborative process. We are happy with the results and the plan, and we are fully supportive of getting this bill moving as expeditiously as possible. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And if you could stick around for questions afterwards, that would be appreciated. Member questions. I see we have a list. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you got. Oh, my apologies. I'm new at this. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ann Linson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and that is sort of expected because I'm just going to echo a lot of what Matt said. I did want to say, too, Secretary Simon brought up the point about the work groups in the interim, which were an excellent opportunity for our city elections officials to get to participate in the process and really talk through what would be the best way to use the funding. And as Secretary Simon said, that was not required regarding this funding. But there are plans in place ready to be executed. And so as my colleague, Mr. Hilgard, said, we really hope that this bill can move quickly and these funds can be distributed to really bolster our election system that we have here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Any other testifiers? Okay. Thank you. Questions? We have a list started here. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm really searching for a little bit of a clarification here. What I heard in testimony from both Representative Nelson and Representative O'Driscoll was inferences about attempts by foreign governments to penetrate our election system. And prior to last November, there was a little bit of coverage about this issue and statements made by the Secretary of State, Simon, with respect to our state system and not the federal system, and that that measures or attempts had been thwarted. And it sounded like or inferred as though the Secretary had implemented something to shore up the integrity of the system, and then there were articles that said no, nothing was changed, that the system as it existed was sufficient, and that that maybe an expression of having taken claim or credit for having done something that wasn't done or wasn't necessary. And so I guess my question directly to all of you at the table is, was Minnesota's election system attempted to be infiltrated by a foreign government, and if so, what evidence do you have of that?
Representative Nelson and Representative O'Driscoll.
I think Representative Steinman would be the person to answer this question. Secretary of State Steinman, yes.
Old habits die hard.
Old habits die hard.
If I may, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you, and Representative Hertels, thank you for the question. So, yes, in 2016, Minnesota was one of 21 states that was targeted by a foreign government. So what does that mean? What does targeted mean? Here's the best analogy I can give you in talking with the intelligence officials and others in the federal government as well as IT experts. If you picture a parking lot and you picture a car thief casing the parking lot for a day or two in a row, maybe he observes traffic patterns, maybe he brings his binoculars, maybe he sort of he just tries to assess whether or not it's worth his while to go in and try to steal a car or more than one car. That's what happened to us. And what the intelligence officials tell me and tell all the secretaries of state is we know who the car thief was, we know who he works for, and we know the purpose for which he was trying to get in. I should mention that of the 21 states, 19, like us, successfully can report that there was no breach, there was no infiltration. Two states, though, were in a very different situation. In Arizona and in Illinois, I would say that the car thief got into the parking lot. And in the case of Illinois in particular, to extend the analogy, the car thief got in the car and turned on the engine. If you saw last year, 60 Minutes ran a report on what happened in Illinois, and it's pretty shocking. So that's what happened. And in terms of 2018, not 2016, but 2018, the election that we just had, we know of no evidence at this point of any attempt to intrude in Minnesota. I say at this point because sometimes the intelligence community is a bit slow in getting back to us. You may recall that in 2016, we didn't have hard evidence and confirmation from intelligence authorities about a breach until the September after the election. So in September of 2017 is when they announced who the 21 states were and then presented us with the evidence. I hope you can understand, I don't want to give a roadmap here in committee to the bad guys. So all I'll say is that we feel good about where we were in 2018 because we didn't get this money and we were the only state in the country not to get the money in time for 2018 election. We had to live by our wits a little bit. We had to get inventive and creative. So last fall, we teamed up with Microsoft, for example. So we went out and sought ways to cover the holes that we knew that we needed to cover. And so we went out and found those temporary, and they were only temporary resources in order to cover this shortfall. But that really underscores the importance of getting this money. I just have to emphasize, Minnesota is the only state in the country, the only one, that did not get this money in time for the 2018 election. And so we lost 8 months on some long-term projects. For example, the statewide voter registration system that Representative O'Driscoll discussed, that is candidly, without giving a roadmap to the bad guys, this is public information, that is the chief vulnerability. So the sooner we can get going on that project, which is a long-term project of recoding and modernizing that system, the better we'll be.
Representative Hertas, follow-up?
Yes, thank you. And so to my question then with regard to whether or not we had the fox circling the chicken coop, as you've described, you had intelligence information on that, but you did or did not have to do anything other than the way the system was presently built from 2004, and that in itself did withstand the integrity of not allowing that to happen. Is that correct?
Secretary Simon.
Representative Hertas, I need to be careful here because I don't want to give a roadmap to the bad guys. And I also...
No, it's just a yes or no question.
But it isn't just a yes or no question, with respect. And so when you say, did we have to do something, I'm loathe in a public hearing to discuss that with you because I don't want to give a roadmap to the bad guys. And there's information that I and two other people in my office have been granted access to by federal intelligence authorities. One of the things, and I have to give credit where it's due, that the administration in Washington did, that Department of Homeland Security did after 2016, was they gave a security clearance for intelligence briefings to all secretaries of state and two staff. So it's secretaries plus two. And I received those intelligence briefings, and this coming Monday in Washington, a few days from now, I'll receive another one from the Department of Homeland Security as well as other secretaries of state. So I don't want to be all cloak and dagger on you, but there are things that I'm not comfortable talking about in a public setting that I think would answer your question, but I'm happy to talk with you offline about that. I think you're entitled to know, as a legislator, the generalities, but I'm loath to get into that in this setting. I hope you can understand that.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, Secretary Simon, and thank you for coming into my office yesterday, and we had a discussion about the bill today, and I also expressed some concerns about our election system, and I would like to take you up on a follow-up offline on my question. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, good morning. I want to be very respectful and mindful of what conversation you just shared with Representative Hertaus, but to the extent that we talk about, as an example, the issues relevant to lines 1.11, 1.14, 1.15, I think it's incumbent upon constitutional officers to protect the data of the voters, but also for the databases that we have in this state, whether they be with various agencies. And so to the extent that I'm not asking you to breach confidentiality, but I'm going to ask it in a broader context, and I appreciate the leeway that the chair will provide me here with this line of question. It's really just one question. At some point, isn't there a need for constitutional officers to be briefed on issues of cybersecurity and its impact on, to your point, Homeland Security briefing you on any nature of cyber attacks upon our systems? But if we as a committee are not made aware of what we need to do, but we're conflicted because we are in a transparent public setting, how do we go about deliberating these issues? In one hand, protecting the sanctity and the confidentiality and security of the data, but in the same sense, giving consideration to those who are charged with making law and assisting the constitutional officers in understanding the, either the severity or the updates necessary to protect our data. You can see the conflict inherent in the conversation that we're having. Secretary.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. I think that's very well put. And as someone who once sat where you're sitting and where other members have sat, I absolutely appreciate that. You know, I wish there was some way that the Department of Homeland Security could extend on a limited basis, maybe it's chairs of committees, maybe it's someone else, that same security clearance so that you're seeing the same information that I'm seeing or the chair is or a ranking member, but that's their call, not mine. Right now the protocol is secretaries plus two, and it's two in their office. That's the rule, and so the three of us have been granted security clearance to get this information to some degree. Maybe this is an old-fashioned concept, but I hope not. There has to be a degree of trust that you know, I and others in a similar situation am telling you what we can tell you and are trying our level best to communicate with you without getting in trouble about some of the things that we're hearing. That's what I'm trying to do at this committee hearing. I'm trying to color inside the lines here so they don't get in trouble for disclosing something I'm not supposed to disclose. That's the best answer I can give and the most sincere answer I can give. You're right. There's a certain information that people in our office will have that legislators who are voting on this stuff won't have. I don't know any way to bridge that gap other than to ask for, and hopefully I've earned your trust on this issue. I think we do share, as evidenced by this optic right here, we share an absolutely bipartisan, nonpartisan dedication to the safety of our system. And I've said many times, you know, our job in the Secretary of State's office and the system as a whole, the job of the system as a whole is keep bad people out. And I don't care who the bad people are, whether it's a foreign government or some other actor or the guy next door. I don't care what their politics are. I don't care which campaign they're trying to help. I don't care which campaign they're trying to hurt. My job is to keep the bad guys out, period. And I don't really care much beyond that, what their motivations are, who's paying them. It doesn't really matter. And that's the orientation of our team in general. So I hope I've engendered some trust, but you're absolutely right to isolate that information imbalance. It's a thing.
Representative Albright, follow up.
Just a comment, no more question, but I think that we share the same urgency, particularly with regard to the safeguarding of an enormous amount of data that not only nefarious activities on the dark web and other places have access to, but I think it is a project that, you know, I've shared with you that we should move forward on, particularly from your position of having a kind of a front row seat to all of this. And so I would encourage us to continue this conversation about how do we provide transparency, but also respect the confidentiality of the data that our citizens have entrusted us with. So thank you, Secretary.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Chair and author, Representative Nelson, you expressed some fears and concerns earlier on in your testimony today about, you know, someone coming in and the registration stuff being wrong and that. And if we as a state were actually HAVA compliant instead of being one of three that has an exception, there wouldn't be anybody denied a ballot. But this bill isn't addressing that. It's addressing the security mm-hmm. of the system, and it's been well articulated. There is a Amendment A6 that the intent is to further ensure that the focus of these funds yep. is first and foremost on that security.
So, Representative Quam, we'll get to amendments here shortly. Did you have a question other than the A6 amendment at this time? You want to get through the list here first before we introduce amendments.
Okay, the chair did not make that clear, and I just, you know, as we're burning through time, we are assured that we shall be able to vote on the amendments.
Representative Quam, I guarantee you we will get through all the amendments today.
And yes. I will defer until you allow that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two brief questions for Secretary Simon. First, by when does the state have to provide its 5% match for the HAVA dollars?
Oh, I'm sorry, Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, we have until March of next year to provide that match. And I should point out it's not a pay-as-you-go system. We can start spending the money before we get the match as long as we ultimately get the match.
Representative Long, follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So since we don't need to provide the match today or even this year, my follow-up question is what we've expended some state dollars that have reduced our the match that we would need to provide. Is it likely or possible that if we wait until we go through our spending process this year that we will be expending additional dollars that would qualify and therefore that we don't know today what the amount would be of our state match?
Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Long, so just to recap, the state match, I'm rounding a bit, was about $330,000. We came up with, I might say, a creative way to get credit for money already spent, and we shopped that past the EAC. That's the organization in the federal government that is keeping track of this money and keeping us honest about it. And they said yes, so we got credit. So we basically saved the state $110,000, which in a $40-some billion budget isn't a massive amount, but it's something. So now the match is 220 instead of 330. We are still working on getting that number down and seeking creative ways to get credit for other money spent. So it is somewhat of a moving target. The good news is, unlike so many things that you'll see in this committee, it's a moving target in a good way, going down, not up. The meter's running in reverse, which is good. So I'm not sure when we'll get final confirmation of what the final number is. For now, I think we should assume, just to be cautious, that it's the 220 and not anything lower. But we think maybe we can get credit for other money and get that match down even further, below 220. We'll see. It isn't yet. So in fairness, right now, as of right now, the state match due by March of 2020 would be 220.
So, well, Representative Driscoll, did you have a comment to add to the Secretary's comments?
My apologies. This may have been discussed when I was collecting the amendments, as we're going to be dealing with those in a little bit. But Representative Long, to your question, it's important to remember that even though the state has time to get its match in place, the funds are still embargoed because the state legislature has to agree to allow the state to spend those monies. So there's two critical issues. We could remove the embargo on the money, which the Secretary's office could proceed with the hiring of the programmers necessary, and then we still do have the match issue, and so we're trying to take care of that all at once because this, in fact, is a budget year, and so we felt that this was an appropriate time to bring that matter forward, along with removing the embargo on the funds.
Thank you, Representative. One last clarification, Secretary. So if we gave you more time, it sounds like we could save the state more money.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Long, that is possible on the match piece. But as this bill travels, this doesn't require determination yet in this committee on the match. This is just the authorization to end what Representative Driscoll calls the embargo on the funds. Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably partially to the bill authors and partially to the Secretary. I'll start out with the question for the Secretary. You know, you talk about trust, and I served with you a little bit, and I do trust you. But we have the issue in the state with the MNLARS and our IT programs, and also with MNSURE that came about, and they were complete disasters. And as I'm looking at the bill, and you know, you've got your work groups set up, but there's really nothing specified in here directly on where the money's going to go, how it's going to be spent, whether the things that you're picking out to spend the money on for the security has been proven in other states. Is there any assurances there?
Representative Green, who is that directed towards?
Well, right now, whoever wants to answer it.
Well, I'll start, but I'll let Secretary Simon finish. But in the bill on lines 111 to 115, and we amended 111 with the First Amendment, but that's specifying what the money's being spent for, what it can be used for. And these are my understanding from the criteria from the federal government. The other thing to give you assurance, Minute is not involved in this at all. Secretary of State has their own program, and they do not work for Minute.
Can I just address that?
Representative Green.
Modernizing statewide voter, and I realize that one was amended, but improving accessibility, implementing security improvements for elections systems, and funding other activities, it's not really specified. It's just saying it's going to go into these areas and we'll decide where they're going to go, and that's my concern.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Mr. Gelbin, as the question is going here, can we secure a room for tonight? Because it seems like we're going a little bit long here.
Chair Nelson, yes, it's been brought to my attention that this room has been reserved. Not this room. A room with details forthcoming. So if we run out of time, my intention is to wrap this up in the next 20 minutes or so, if possible, to get through the amendments as well as a final vote. But if need be, we can re-adjourn this evening. Recess until this evening.
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes, Secretary Simon.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Green. Fair questions, all of those. A couple things I would say. First, the working group did provide a lot more information. The problem with putting that in statute is some of the stuff you got to put out for bid. It's really tough to get that level of specificity in statute. And the other thing I would point out, and your question is a very fair one, is we modeled this language exactly after the same language that then-Secretary Kiffmeyer used in 2003 when she came before the House and Senate. By the way, it passed the House floor unanimously. It passed the Senate floor unanimously, literally not a single vote against it, no conditions. It was the same, almost the same exact language. We're happy to furnish that with you. So we sort of started with the assumption, and we've talked to her about that, that, hey, let's just do what the legislature already did the last time this batch of money came through, which was not to sort of get into nickels and dimes, but to get into what the federal government had authorized it for. And I just want to reiterate, because you're right, you want safeguards that the money's being spent the way it's intended to be spent by Congress, and that's where the EAC comes in, and that's why we have to keep track of our time in 15-minute increments. That's why they audit this. That's why they demand periodic updates about how the money is spent. Interestingly, this morning, before I came to this hearing, our in-house counsel, Bert Black, who many of you know, let me know that later on today we'll be signing and sending one of our periodic HAVA reports for the 2003 money. We're still doing it. 16 years later, we still have to do periodic reports. Literally today, I will be signing and sending to the EAC one of our periodic reports for how the county, we don't have any left in the state. We exhausted our supply of money in the state years ago, but there's still counties, Yellow Medicine County is an example, that still has some HAVA money from the first batch left over, and we have to sign off on that, and they still do auditing and analysis of that. So literally today, I'm going to be signing off on a report that they still require for the money that was given 16 years ago.
Representative Green, follow up.
One more quick question. You say that the money is available for another year or so, but what we need to know is how much time do you need to get this stuff implemented before 2020?
Secretary Simon.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Green. If I was unclear about that, that's my I take ownership of that. We have until next year to get the match. We have 5 years to spend the money. So 5 years from the time of enactment. So that would be 2023. So we have until 2023 to spend the money. We have until 2020 to get the match that allows us to spend the money. That's the issue.
Seeing no further questions, we do have three amendments. Oh, we do. Yes. Seeing no further questions, we have three amendments in your packet. The first is the A4 amendment. Representative Albright, is the A4 your amendment?
It is, Mr. Chair, and we are not offering that amendment at the time.
No longer offering the amendment.
Offering that amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So seeing that the A4 has been withdrawn, the next amendment at the desk is the A5 amendment. Representative Albright, is that your amendment as well?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Okay, could you please speak to your amendment?
I would move the A5 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, moving the amendments.
And I would request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, and to the points that have been already heard by Secretary Simon, this is not a partisan issue. This is an issue that affects all of us because we are delegated to and charged with making sure that we protect the public safety, and that infers to their election processes. What we are doing with this amendment is providing the Secretary of State and his office and his programmers with the money that, by his comments, has already been expended. What we're doing is we're replenishing that amount of money now. And I think it speaks to the urgency of the issue. If Representative Nash were here, I think he'd probably speak more eloquently to it from a cyber and IT perspective. But these projects typically do not roll out and piecemeal themselves. You need to know what the budget, the scope, and parameters are typically right away, and you front that money right up front, and then you dole it out in terms of the work provided. So our intent by offering this amendment is to provide the Secretary of State's office with the full wherewithal to get this project done in an expedited manner without a concern about coming back to the legislature and this committee for additional funding that of no purpose other than realization that he needed the additional money. We're replenishing his resources that have already been expended on this. There really is no harm in adopting this amendment, given the fact that if the money isn't spent, it just comes and reverts back to the budget itself because of what Secretary Simon has already said. So we did offer a substantial amount of money to the Secretary of State's office in the supplemental bill last year. It was passed off the floor, but unfortunately that did not pass into law. So what we're trying to do is reflect upon to Chair Nelson's A3 amendment. We're reflecting by adopting this an enhancement to that. I will draw your attention to the handout that I put in the packets today. What we're doing with this amendment is really just reflecting the amount of money that the Secretary of State's already requested. We want to provide that to him up front so that he can do the job that he wants to do, and we affirm that we also want him to do. So let's provide that amount of money up front, make sure that he's got the resources to do the job right and on an expedited basis. So thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Chair Nelson, comments on the amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Albright, I don't support the A5 amendment, and here are my reasons why. Number one reason, if we put this in there, we have to then hold this bill over for our budget because it would count against our budget target. So therefore, it would delay this being implemented. Number two, that was last year's information, and as the Secretary stated, when this bill started out this year, they'd already been credited for $110,000. My amendment, as I was told, and what the language that came from the Secretary of State's office, they've now already spent $167,000 that's being credited for that match. So really the only amount of money they need left for that match is almost $163,000. And that would be part of our budget going forward that we have in this division, that we would conclude that hopefully by the time our bill comes through, they may have spent more, and that amount will be less. So at this time, I don't think it's appropriate for this amendment. Again, the information that you passed out in the packets was last year's supplemental budget request, and things have changed since then. And so, members, I would say I request a no vote on this amendment moving forward, and because we're going to include this money that he's going to need as part of our budget coming out of this committee.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Secretary Simon, would you like to add some comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's hard to say no to Representative Albright, hard to say no to the offer of $220,000.
Can I have you repeat that one more time? It really feels good when you say that, Secretary.
Yes. Well, thank you, Representative. Just for process reasons, I mean, I totally understand and very much appreciate what you're trying to do. It comes in all the right kind of spirit. But I think, given that I want this bill to move as quickly as possible off the floor of the Minnesota House, attaching an appropriation to it, I think we'll slow it down. We've already lost 8 months from the end of last session, and we really need to get going on, frankly, the recoding process for the statewide voter registration system. So with respect, even though I love what this amendment is trying to do for procedural reasons, you know, I hope that we can defer this, not necessarily defeat it, but just defer it, until such time as this committee gets into numbers and budget.
Thank you, Secretary. Representative Albright?
I have a couple of questions. The members, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that the handout I gave to you is actually for the 2021 biennial budget, so it is current, contrary to what comments have been made. I do recall, Secretary Simon, last time that we heard this bill relevant to HAWA, you did want it to run separately, as opposed from the supplemental, because it was that important. And as I have just been informed by counsel, this is for fiscal 19, so it would have not effect on the budget for the coming year. I do have an oral amendment to my A5 amendment, Mr. Chair, if you would be willing to accept or hear that at this time.
Let's hear your oral amendments.
I would strike $220,000 and insert $163,000. And Mr. Chair, I have just a quick comment on the oral amendment.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, in reflection upon what we've heard from Chair Nelson, accommodating that, certainly do not want to change the effect of the money, but in reflective, be penny perfect. That's our job. I want to reflect that oral amendment to properly reflect the amount of money that we identify as needful by the Secretary of State's office.
Okay. We have some questions. Yes. Representative Claiborne.
I just have one quick question, Mr. Chair. So I just want to, since I'm new, I just want to ask for clarification on this document for whoever would answer, Chair Nelson. So when these documents were prepared for 2021, would that not have been done in 2017, 2018, based on numbers given to you at that time?
I'm happy to just articulate that. If you look in the bottom right-hand corner, this is from November of 2018.
I understand.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you. I understand that, but I'm just asking if these monies would have been appropriated in the last biennium. That's my
So, Representative Claiborne, perhaps Ms. Roberts would be best could provide some information on that.
Mr. Chair and members, this is, as Representative Albright stated, a request going forward into the current biennium that was prepared by the Secretary of State's office this fall. Because they are a constitutional office, they present their budget separate from the governor's budget, which we will get later. And there wasn't any money appropriated previously for this.
Thank you very much for the clarification. I appreciate that.
Okay. So at this time, let's put the amendments.
Mr. Chair,
let's vote on the amendment to the amendment.
We need to take up the oral amendment.
Mr. Chair, can because it's his amendment that he's amending. Can he just be that as a clarification, incorporate into his amendment as the author of the amendment, and the author is just changing his amendment.
Okay, and it seems to be clear enough with the dollar amount change. Okay.
I think we have agreement.
But anyway, he incorporated into his amendment, and then we can vote on the main amendment.
Okay. So with that. Okay. A roll call was called on this. Again, the author of the amendment is requesting a no vote. If we can proceed with the roll call. The author of the bill is requesting a no vote.
All right. Vote on amendment A5.
As amended.
As amended. Chair Nelson.
No.
Vice Chair Carlson?
No.
Representative Albright?
Aye.
Representative Akam?
No.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hertas?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Cleburne?
No.
Representative Lippert?
No.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Mason?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
There being 4 ayes and 11 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Next, we have the A6 amendment. Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A6 amendment and the effect of A6.
1 second, Mr. Chair. The speaker is here, and I believe she has some gifts for the committee.
You know, this has been hard enough as it is.
Mr. Vice Chair, I'm sure you're doing a fantastic job, but the governor and the lieutenant governor have challenged us in Find the Kind to do something nice for somebody. And so our nice thing is to bring you donuts, even as you go into overtime. So you can kind of ignore us and just take a donut, and I'll bring a Kleenex because we don't have napkins. And then we should just alert Secretary Simon that we have challenged him along with Attorney General Keith Ellison and State Auditor Julie Blaha to do the next Find the Kind. And we respect that the committee will get back to its business.
Thank you, Speaker Hartman. Thank you so much for the treats. We do appreciate it. All right, let's just take a minute and allow for everybody to grab a donut.
Mr. Chair, this won't cause us to go late tonight, will it? Unkind interruption.
You know, at this point, the script's kind of thrown out the window. Thank you very much.
No. And Mr. Chair, we could have Representative Quam explain his amendment.
Yes, Representative Quam, if you could please explain your amendment.
Well, I would rather the effects of kindness make people a little more friendly towards it. But basically what the A6 amendment, Mr. Chair and members, is it would remove the words "but not limited to any of the following activities." So it still allows the modernization of the statewide voter system, improve accessibility, prepare training and train local officials, implement security improvements for election systems. It allows all of that. And the intent is, because as it's been brought up, and even the people in the public realize, there have been issues with rolling out IT, and whether it's METS, Mendlars, or any of the other systems that have had problems, it's not just cost overruns, but it's time. And I think, as it's been stressed, the importance of this, since it was delayed because 8 months, we didn't get it signed, even though it went through the chambers. is if the focus is on getting that done first, focusing the funds on this list of activities would maybe help ensure, because as you're working on the project, you maybe have to add additional personnel to meet the timeline. And the intent of this amendment is to, you know, keep the focus on the main issue of taking an older system, updating it in a timely fashion, because we have elections coming up. We can't all of a sudden, oh, we're delaying elections because our system isn't. No, that's not acceptable. So that's what the intent is.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Chair Nelson, any questions on the
and Mr. Chair, I do ask for a roll call.
Oh, yes, for a roll call. A roll call has been requested. Chair Nelson, any comments on the amendments?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Quam, while I understand what you're saying here, I ask you to vote no on this amendment. Just like, I mean, there's a statement that says it's hard to predict things, especially about the future. By taking this out, it makes it more, it restricts it more on some of the stuff. It's something that may come up that as far as security or something else that the Secretary of State may need to spend this money on, and this limits them from being able to do that, which means he may have to come back here with another bill and would delay us getting security done properly. So I would say vote no on this amendment.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative Albright, I heard you had a quick question.
Yeah, I would speak in favor of the A6 amendment. One, probably more than anything, protectionary measures for the Secretary of State, because if HAVA is that diligent about in 15-minute increments, we'd certainly want to have the language as tight and succinct as possible. I think the A6 offered by Representative Quam speaks to that. To the point of a no vote offered by Chair Nelson, this does not preclude the Secretary of coming back, because he already has to come back now because of the rejection of the A4 amendment. So I would speak in favor of the A6 and hopefully give it better consideration than my amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Secretary Simon, any quick comments on the amendment, the A6 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I defer to Chair Nelson.
All right. With that being said, a roll call has been requested. If we can now take the roll.
Roll call vote on Amendment A6. Chair Nelson.
No.
Vice Chair Carlson.
No.
Representative Albright.
Aye.
Representative Akam.
No.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Green.
Yes.
Representative Hertas.
Yes.
Representative Hewitt.
No.
Representative Cleavorn.
No.
Representative Lippert.
No.
Representative Long.
No.
Representative Mason.
No.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Quam.
C.
Four ayes and 11 nays. The amendment is not adopted. Chair Nelson, any closing comments that you would like to make before renewing your motion?
Mr. Chair, no. I think we've discussed this enough. Like I said, this is about providing the Secretary of State the ability to spend the money that has come from the federal government and moving forward. And a later date, we'll come up with the matching, whatever matching money he may need at that time. We'll be part of our budget from this committee. And I think Representative O'Driscoll wants to say a brief.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I will be shorter than Representative Nelson. Remember I said my data is in there, your data is in there, the people in Minnesota's data is in that system. We owe a duty to protect that, just like when you and I are customers at banks and our credit cards and investments and others, they owe a duty to keep that data secure. We are that agency on behalf of the people of the state of Minnesota. Please vote yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. Just a quick couple of questions. One is for the author of the bill. If Chair Nelson, if you could give us an update or status on your companion bill in the Senate.
Well, Mr. Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I believe Senator Kiffmeyer has the bill, and I'm not sure where she's got it yet on the Senate. I don't normally pay attention or worry about what happens in the lesser body.
Senator Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And well, in light of, I certainly appreciate the, you know, 1714 and the Irish analogy. I didn't really realize that about Representative O'Driscoll, but, you know, that's for him to. But I guess in light of the companions going on in the Senate, I'd also like to make a motion that we re-refer House File 17 to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's the motion, is the system going to be referred back to Ways and Means with the recommendation that it go 14. To the... To
members, we'll get to House
File 17. Oh, you want
17 in just a minute. If we can wrap up our final motion here on House File 14, we'll get to that shortly. Okay. Representative Nelson moves House File 14 as amended be referred to Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that be placed on the General Register. And I guess now we call for a vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion passes. House File 14, as amended, is referred to the Ways and Means Committee with the recommendation that it be placed on the General Register. Okay, moving forward here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would
Representative,
move,
Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I would remove the House File 17 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Representative O'Driscoll, any comments?
I'm good with that.
Representative O'Driscoll, okay, given the fact that we have a consensus on the dais.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would make a motion that we re-refer House File 17 to Ways and Means.
Okay, vote on that. The motion before the division is to move House File 17 to Ways and Means. Comments from
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I would say to vote against that amendment, because House File 17 would the money that's in that would count against our budget target, and therefore that's why I'm laying it over for possible inclusion. That the money that's going to be needed there will come out of this committee as part of our omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, in response to
Representative Albright.
Chair Nelson's comments, if you look on one line 1.8. It is just pursuant to Help America Vote Act singly.
Okay, with that, we will call all those in favor of
the amendment.
Moving the Albright Amendment to all in favor of moving the Albright Amendment, say aye.
Mr. Chair, point of inquiry?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, we are not moving an amendment.
We are moving
a motion to re-refer.
Motion. Let me just make a note. I'll restate. All in favor of the Albright motion to re-refer, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay.
No.
The nays prevail. All right, where am I? We are back to House File 17. Okay. Motion. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just seeking a little bit of clarification here on the Minnesota House Research Summary on 17, it refers under the title HF 17, refers to it as first subcommittee engrossment. But I notice on the bill itself, on HF 17, authored by O'Driscoll, the bill was read for the first time and referred to committee and GovOp. Then it says adoption of report and amended and re-referred to the Committee of Ways and Means. Are these engrossments correct, or could you clarify that, please?
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Matt, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, so the summary is in your packet. I think it's just one summary hole, but the engrossment, the actual bill that's in front of the committee is the correct engrossment for you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The bill is labeled.
So at this time, we're going to lay over House File 17 for possible inclusion in the division omnibus bill. Meeting adjourned.